Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, happy to be here to introduce our show to you today, July 9th, 2005. Our focus today is on the U.S. and human rights, Guantanamo and beyond, and here's what we have coming up. Our news will feature audio about the G8 protests happening now in Scotland. Then in our first hour, Damon Thomas interviews Peter Somsich, head of the Seacoast chapter of Amnesty International, and Frank Heffron, a retired lawyer in Exeter, New Hampshire. Frank is working on a case involving Murat Kurnaz, a young Turkish man detained by the U.S. and being held at Guantanamo Bay. They talk particularly about the United States' recent record on human rights. In our second hour, Tom Jackson talks with John Hudson, Dean and President of Franklin Pierce Law School, who is of counsel on the legal team of several former detainees held by the U.S. who were tortured. The former detainees are suing Donald Rumsfeld, saying that he, as Secretary of Defense, should be held accountable. We'll also bring you great music, people's history, and a poem to celebrate Pablo Neruda's birthday. First for news. In keeping with the theme of today's show, we begin with this press release from the American Civil Liberties Union. Family members sue for release of American citizen detained in Iraq. On July 6, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit against top U.S. government officials on behalf of the family of an American citizen detained indefinitely in Iraq for nearly 2 months without charge or access to family or lawyer. The relatives of Cyrus Carr, a 44-year-old part-time college professor who had been in Iraq filming a historical documentary, charge that Carr has been unjustly held since May 17th, despite the fact that the family has received assurances from the FBI that Carr has been cleared of any wrongdoing. Carr's American relatives filed the lawsuit in federal court in Washington, D.C., along with international law specialist and former chair of Amnesty International USA, Paul Hoffman, and Duke Law professor Erwin Chemerinsky, against President Bush, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and Secretary of the Army Francis J. Harvey. Carr grew up along the West Coast after emigrating from Iran as a child, served in the Navy for 3 years, then earned a bachelor's degree from San Jose State University and a master's from Pepperdine University. For the past 3 years, he has been working on a historical documentary and manuscript about the Persian king Cyrus the Great. Carr and his cameraman Farshid Faraji had traveled to Iran, Tajikistan, Turkey, and Afghanistan, and collected dozens of hours of film. Carr liked critical footage of Babylon and entered Iraq only after securing appropriate permits and visas from the U.S. and Iraqi governments and from Kurdish authorities. After Carr missed his return flight to Los Angeles, his relatives confirmed that he was detained by Iraqi police and turned over to U.S. forces while in Iraq. After searching his Los Angeles apartment and administering a lie detector test to Carr, the FBI asserted it, quote, knew Cyrus better than Cyrus, unquote, and an FBI agent stated the military just needs to cross all their T's and dot all their I's, and that Carr's release was imminent. But after 50 days, Carr is still being detained. The lawsuit charges that Carr's detention violates his constitutional rights, federal law, international law, and the regulations of the U.S. military. For our next story, as everyone has heard much about already, London was a target of an attack this week. Here's another perspective on that event by the Interpress Service. London hit as skepticism grows on terror war. Thursday's terror attacks against London's public transportation system came amid indications of growing skepticism about the effectiveness of U.S. President George Bush's war on terrorism. The Gallup organization released a new survey just days ago, which found that a plurality of 41% of U.S. respondents believe that neither the U.S. and its allies nor the terrorists are currently winning the war, whether Thursday's attack will add to that skepticism and further erode public support for Bush's leadership remains to be seen. Adding to Bush's vulnerability is the fact that most Democrats, who generally stood by the president on foreign policy matters between the 9/11 attacks and the onset of last year's presidential election campaign, have been arguing for more than a year that Bush's invasion of Iraq has diverted key resources and attention from the war against Al-Qaeda. The BBC reported that a previously unknown group calling itself the Secret Organization of Al-Qaeda in Europe had claimed responsibility for the explosions. The group reportedly warned, quote, the Danish and Italian government and all other crusaders, unquote, to withdraw troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, and that the attacks were carried out in, quote, revenge from the British Zionist crusader government in retaliation for the massacres Britain is committing in Iraq and Afghanistan, end quote. Bush, who arrived at Glen Eagles Wednesday, expressed his solidarity with the British and repeated an oft-used line that the ideology of hope will win over the ideology of hate. He also said the bombing showed that the war on terror goes on. While the latter observation was unquestionably accurate, it begged the larger question of how that war is defined and carried out. The fact that Al-Qaeda, or one of its affiliates, has now struck in the heart of another Western capital, and Washington's closest ally no less, could add to the growing sense that the Iraq War was and remains a diversion from the fight against Al-Qaeda. At the same time, according to Stephen Call, director of the University of Maryland's Program of International Policy Attitudes, the attacks could favor Bush, at least in the short term. Quote, whenever there are bombings close to home, it generates fear, and fear intensifies concern about terrorism and makes people marginally more receptive to the kind of frames that Bush has used, he said. Meanwhile, nearby in Scotland, the so-called G8, the group of eight of the most powerful nations on Earth, met. Outside the insulated resort where they made plans for the rest of us here on the planet, thousands and thousands of protesters demonstrated their wishes for a different world. When mentioned in the media at all, numbers of windows broken or rocks thrown were the focus of such coverage. Tony Blair himself recently said, quote, it would be very odd if people came to protest against this G8. I don't quite know what they'll be protesting against, end quote. So, let's consider what they might be protesting. We bring you this 15-minute piece called Why Close the G8? This audio comes from a film by the same name made in advance of the G8 summit protests happening now. The film was made by the Camcorder Guerrillas in Scotland, released on May 1st, 2005.
Interrupt their game of golf.
We want the biggest possible protest there. We want to close it down.
I would just describe the G8 briefly. It's about eight powerful countries will gather together each year.
They are making money out of providing support in the name of support to other countries.
Well, they have a forum for them to discuss things that are in their interest, which already by excluding the rest of the world and only discussing what the eight richest countries puts a platform for injustice, because they will decide things that will influence the rest of the world.
The people making those decisions around the G8 table are making decisions that affect the whole world, and life and death decisions, really. So it's not about being political or radical necessarily, it's just about having a concern for your brothers and sisters around the planet.
The G8 has, over the last 30 years, become the dominant power over global and economic affairs. And the decisions made at their annual meetings have come to shape all aspects of the world as we know it. The G8 works with the World Trade Organization to decide trade rules and structural adjustment programs for developing countries. The World Bank provides the cash needed by the developing countries, and the International Monetary Fund monitors and collects the debt. When the G8 meets this year, one of their main agenda items will be climate change.
I don't think the G8 are addressing climate change, no. That even the Kyoto Agreement attempting to reduce carbon emissions, for example, has no longer been ratified by the United States.
Highly respected international scientists, we are all beginning to agree that at the current rate of depletion, we face the extinction of our entire species within two generations.
For me, climate change is no longer a theory. It has become fact.
It is very clear that we are seeing warning signs that we neglect at our level.
Blair's government wants to discuss climate change, and it wants to discuss solutions to climate change, and these solutions are things like carbon trading. And for example, you've got in Grangemouth a situation where people are living in a very, very polluted area with an enormous big BP oil refinery, and BP are taking part in this trial carbon emissions trading scheme, which is where they can basically sell the pollution they're making and buy clean air to offset the pollution. And what they're actually doing is buying carbon credits from a eucalyptus plantation in Brazil. And basically at the moment, Brazil is at great risk of turning into a kind of carbon absorbing sink for Europe. The other big issue that's affecting climate change is aviation emissions. There's no fuel tax on aviation fuel. There's no VAT on it. They're getting a massive subsidy for promoting air travel. So you have, on the one hand, the most polluting form of transport, the one that globalization depends on, moving goods back and forward across the world, and its emissions are not even being calculated in the figures. If that isn't an unjust world, I don't know what is.
Another thing that the G8 is involved in is determining the levels of economic aid that go to the rest of the world. And there's recently been a lot of public relations by the government about this aid to Africa program.
America's alliance with Great Britain has never been stronger. And we're working closely every day to spread that freedom.
The G8's record on poverty reduction is appalling. While they've been in charge, the gap between rich and poor has nearly doubled.
It's a fantastically rich continent in terms of minerals, in terms of oil, in terms of, you know, population, in terms of creativity, in terms of culture. Yet it's the poorest place in terms of the capitalist measure of wealth.
The G8 is the architect of a system that forces developing countries to open up their borders to free trade. Multinational corporations from the West are encouraged to move in and set up shop. Developing countries are being bled dry of their wealth and colonized by a brand-led monoculture that leaves a trail of poverty and environmental destruction in its wake.
They even arrive in Africa and say, we'll tell you what's wrong with your countries. will provide the solutions. They cannot provide a solution because they are actually the problem.
Whole chunks of the British aid budget, so the money that's supposed to be going from the British government to make the world a better place and to help people in poverty, is being used actually to fund institutions like the Adam Smith Institution and other private consultancy firms to advise people in countries such as South Africa and other countries how to privatise their resources.
For every dollar the US puts into the World Bank, $2 goes back into its own economy.
Blair and Brown competing with each other to say suddenly, after all these years, they're friends of Africa. They've done so much damage to Africa over the years, now they're suddenly the friends of Africa.
Unbelievably, one of Blair's priorities for the G8 and for his so-called Action for Africa is to set up rapid reaction military squads. Now, it seems to me that this is a complete joke. Well, Africa needs a lot of things. The one thing it doesn't need is more troops and more weapons.
Even if third world debt was cancelled, the free trade and privatisation that the G8 is implementing in Africa ensures that the continent will remain poor, indebted and reliant on the West. One issue missing from the G8's main agenda is Iraq.
It will still be a huge problem in Iraq, and they may not want to discuss that publicly, not least because there are continuing divisions within the G8 about the Iraq war.
My message to G8 would be actually speaking about Iraq and speaking about the troops that's in Iraq, because it's time the troops came back home. Every time Iraq's been brought up, they keep pushing it aside.
My background's Iranian, so for me, coming and protesting against the G8 is not just protesting about globalisation. Is protesting about against the war on terror, which, you know, Iran could be the next target. And we're talking about my relatives being bombed after Iraq.
I'll be focusing on protesting at Faslane against the weapons of mass destruction, which are in Faslane, but weren't in Iraq.
Hopefully, interrupt their game of God.
We want the biggest possible process there. We want to close it down.
My big worry about G8 that people locally only see it as a big riot and don't see the issues behind it, and that the mainstream media is going to distort what the actual politics are about and why people oppose it.
There are thousands of people committed to opposing the G8 through non-violent direct action.
Well, fortunately, some parts of the media have chosen to ignore that, and they've chosen to hype things up and draw parallels with Genoa some years ago.
There are a million and one reasons why people should protest against the G8.
We should go to Scotland to basically make their meeting as difficult as possible.
Quite legitimately, people have concerns about the issues that the world leaders are discussing.
We want the biggest possible process there. We want to close it down.
We're wanting trade justice, more and better aid, and we want 100% cancellation of third world debts.
We have to let them know that we're not going away.
To push the issues that we want them to push.
We're fighting for justice, we're fighting for equality, we're fighting for our freedom.
They decide about us, then we should take part of that.
You know, we're the ones that are paying our taxes to get these people to meet in Scotland in order to better debate how to rip us off most effectively. That's why you have to go to G8 and campaign outside Gleneagles, and hopefully interrupt their game of golf. I'm in victory here, you're the rebel warrior. I am risen alone with my head held high. I will hope the best when the cause of the oppressed no longer reach the sky. When the sound of the sword of the oppressor no longer rings in battle, hear my war cry. Hey, hey.
Yes, I'm the genius, I guess, but I'm at the top. God, now pray on your conscience, you be praying for forgiveness. See, no, the evidence, no longer need a witness. So take my word, man, here's my sentence.
In the run-up to the 2005 Gleneagles G8 summit, there are a number of demonstrations and actions planned.
On the 11th and 12th of June in Glasgow and Gleneagles, the CREATE Summit is calling for people to help with projects that help positive social change.
On the 18th of June, a bike caravan is leaving Brighton and cycling to Gleneagles to raise awareness of climate change.
On the 2nd of July, people will be taking to the streets of Edinburgh for the Make Poverty History demonstration.
On the 3rd of July, people will be in Edinburgh to discuss and debate the alternatives to the G8.
On Monday the 4th of July, protesters will be blockading Faslane Nuclear Submarine Base in order to draw attention to the weapons of mass destruction that are here in Scotland.
On the 5th of July, at the controversial Dungavel Detention Centre, there will be a Make Refugee Welcome demonstration.
The 6th of July sees the start of the summit and mass demonstrations against the G8 with the message of another world is possible.
7th of July is the People's Golfing Action demonstration at Gleneagles. And the 8th of July is a global day of action against climate change, which will see protests around the planet to raise awareness about climate change.
Because if you do a demonstration one time in the year, two times in the year, it's not enough.
A huge difference could be made if we as local people change the way we shop.
And just support as many local businesses as possible, especially people who are involved in food production.
We have to start re-educating ourselves about taking more responsibility.
And if we really want alternatives to all these various issues, then we all actually do have to come together and start looking for an alternative world.
If people start making the links in their everyday lives and trying to change the world in that way, then that is just as effective.
And that also is, I think, the very ground level starting point of resisting things like the GA.
This film was made by the Camcorder Gorillas, and you can find out more about them and how to get a copy of this film at their website, which is at camcordergorillas.net.
Good afternoon, my name is Damon Thomas, and I'd like to welcome our listeners to another interview segment on Making Waves here on WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. We'll be speaking with Frank Heffron and Peter Somsich. And I invite our listeners to stay tuned for what will be a most interesting and engaging discussion. The subject will be, in part, the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, designated by some international observers as a concentration camp, and in particular, the specific case of one of Guantanamo's detainees, Murat Kurnaz. By way of introduction, Frank Heffron, one of my guests, is a retired lawyer living in Exeter after practicing law for 37 years in Massachusetts and New York. In the early 1960s, Frank was a staff attorney for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, working on desegregation of public facilities such as schools and public parks, and on capital punishment for rape cases. Frank is now involved in various community and political activities, which included a run for New Hampshire State Representative in 2002, and involvement with Seacoast Chapter 550 of Amnesty International USA. Peter Somsich comes to us having been born in Budapest, Hungary, and his parents fled to America after the 1956 uprising, and it was perhaps the reason he got involved with Amnesty International in 1971, and this has been a motivation to his work in both the United States and abroad since that time. Gentlemen, welcome to Making Waves, and thank you for taking the time to be here.
Yes, thank you very much, Damon.
Thank you very much, Damon.
I'll preface my discussion with just some introductory observations by David Cole. Cole is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, who has written and commented extensively on the subject of Guantanamo Bay. He's remarked that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has sounded almost flabbergasted in recent months that anybody could be critical of the military's detention of hundreds of people without trial at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. These people are being held not because they, quote, stole a car or robbed a bank, unquote, Rumsfeld has said with his trademark sarcasm, but because they are enemy combatants and terrorists. It's only common sense that different rules should apply. Now, as Cole noted, to a certain extent, Rumsfeld has a point. The laws of war have long recognized the right to detain the other side's soldiers for the duration of the conflict without lawyers or trials, Al-Qaeda brutally attacked us on September 11, and most of the world approved of our military response. That conflict, as Cole asserts, is not yet over. Yet Guantanamo has become a black mark on the United States' reputation, even among our staunchest allies. The International Committee of the Red Cross, one of, if not the only organization to be granted access to the prisoners at one time, departed from its long-standing policy against commenting on prison conditions to condemn prisoner treatment at Guantanamo. Newspapers worldwide routinely carry stories and editorials harshly critical of U.S. policies at Guantanamo. The complaint is not that Al-Qaeda terrorists should be released, but that innocent people must be. And the United States has arguably for the first time asserted unilateral power to pick up anyone, anywhere in the world, label him an enemy combatant, and hold him for as long as it wishes without any hearing or judicial review that might distinguish the innocent from the enemy. And the complaint is not that holding prisoners of war in a specific conflict is improper, but that by defining the conflict as a war on all terrorist organizations of global reach, we have rendered these powers and the resulting detentions permanent. Still, detention without charges is nothing compared with the torture and assassination other nations have employed against suspected terrorists. So why is Guantanamo, as well as other certain U.S. facilities, holding facilities, so widely condemned? Well, Cole submits that the reason lies beyond Guantanamo, and it's like the police shooting of a black man that touches off an urban riot because it resonates with more systemic unease. The Guantanamo detentions are seen as a symbol of a much broader problem, and Cole has argued that the broader problem is the Bush administration's attitude towards the rule of law. When it serves the administration's interest, the United States applauds it, exports it, and holds others to it, but when the rules don't go its way, the administration ignores them, overrides them, or breaches them. We've dropped out of the Kyoto Accords, opposed the International Criminal Court, and most conspicuously bypassed the UN Security Council when it opposed our declaring war on Iraq. The administration insists that different rules ought to apply at Guantanamo and other U.S. holding facilities, but the world sees an administration that's not interested in applying any rules there. It invokes the law of war but refuses to afford the detainees the hearings the Geneva Convention requires. And it continues to oppose any judicial review, insisting that the detainees are foreign nationals outside of our borders and so have no constitutional rights. It wasn't, for example, until the Supreme Court recently decided over the government's objections to take on the legal challenges by the Guantanamo detainees and by U.S. citizen Yasser Hamdi. The Pentagon announced that Hamdi would be allowed to talk to his lawyer, that the juveniles and several others at Guantanamo would be released, and that the military would provide annual reviews for those still detained. The fact that the Pentagon made these overtures only when threatened with legal oversight underscores the necessity of the rule of law. So Guantanamo is, in short, the perfect symbol of what the administration has sought generally in the war on terrorism, which is the authority to act without the constraints of law. The nations of the world are concerned that we want that authority not only on an isolated leasehold in nearby Cuba, but in their backyards as well. I'm interested, gentlemen, in each of your comments as to Professor Cole's assessment of what Guantanamo represents. You've dealt with Guantanamo certainly in the context of a specific case, and Frank, I know that's particularly true in your instance. Peter, for all I know, with you as well. But I'm hoping each of you can give your own evaluation of the situation, and let's open it up not simply to a discussion of Guantanamo, but perhaps holding facilities in general, as a prelude to discussing Mr. Kernaz's case. Frank.
The overall thrust of what David Cole says certainly makes all the sense in the world to me. It seems that after September 11, the United States government decided it would do everything it had to do to get the terrorists before the terrorists got us. And they certainly seem to have made a very clear decision that they were going to throw out the rule book. There would be no laws, there would be no prohibitions, no inhibitions at all. As to what they would do, they would sweep up people who may or may not have been terrorists. They would interrogate them. They would do whatever they had to do. They authorized specific rules that were designed to permit the kinds of treatment of persons in detention that are not in accordance with international law. And they tried to do it in such a way that they could never be prosecuted for war crimes. So it's a very scary situation. I don't really feel qualified as a citizen to make too much of a judgment about that. I am offering you my opinions. I am here as someone who has studied a particular case, and I'll get into that later, but now I'll turn it over to Peter.
Yes, I want to add to Frank's comments, and I want to make clear that both of us are here representing Amnesty International, so we'd like to use references that our executive director, Dr. Bill Schultz, has already made regarding these issues. And one of the things that he has said in his annual report speech on May 25th this year is that if the U.S. government continues to shirk its responsibilities, that is to say, allow a full investigation of the allegations, then Amnesty International is calling on foreign governments to uphold their obligation under international law by investigating all senior U.S. officials involved in the torture scandal. I mean, this is an obligation that other countries and we have signed, that if a country violates its international obligations, other countries are obligated to take action. And if those investigations support prosecution of American officials, those governments should arrest any official who enters their territory. This is what happened to Augusto Pinochet when he was apprehended in London at the time, because someone decided at the higher level that the crimes he was alleged to have committed were egregious enough to warrant foreign governments intervening and arresting him. And also, from the same statement by Dr. Schultz, our previous Secretary of State Colin Powell warned back in 2002 that a failure to apply international law to detainees in Afghanistan may provoke some individual foreign prosecutors to investigate and prosecute our officials and our troops. And it's not too late for the Bush administration to heed these warnings today, and that's why our organization has been calling for a full and independent investigation of all these allegations. And one final comment about the comparison to the Gulag. Well, in fact, the comparison was to say that it is the Gulag of our times. And why that was mentioned was because there are similarities to the Soviet-era gulags. We, as an organization, were among the most vocal advocates for those victims of the gulag back then. And I would only just mention 3 points that were the similarities between those gulags and the situation in Guantanamo or detentions in general are similar. And that is that the Soviet Union had a network of prison camps throughout a large territories during the 50s and the 80s, in which political prisoners and ethnic and religious groups were persecuted and imprisoned. We, too, now have a network of prisons throughout the world, not just in Guantanamo, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and we are outsourcing the investigation of some detainees to other countries as well, sometimes under the secrecy of the CIA, avoiding the watchful eyes of the International Red Cross. So there's a similarity right there. Many of the prisoners that we adopted from Amnesty International were, in fact, being held in these gulags back then, and we were the primary supporters of them at the time. So we know of what we speak here. Also, the Soviet gulags were used to arrest and intimidate opposition people within the country of Russia at the time, or Soviet Union. And there was no legal process, no fair trials, no lawyers, and no notification of families, and often abuse, torture, and psychological experimentation on these prisoners. That, too, is alleged to happen under American authority at this time. And the treatment of prisoners in the gulags violated at the time international laws and human rights protections, as we claim the United States is doing in many situations today. So that's why we think there are lots of similarities to this situation.
I remind our listening audience, who is probably very well aware of the fact that Amnesty International has come under fire recently by certain factions in the mainstream media for Amnesty's labeling of Guantanamo and other United States prisons and holding facilities as a gulag. Your thoughts, gentlemen, on the nature and the reasons for these criticisms?
There seems to be a rule that you can't use the word gulag, you can't use the word Nazi, you can't ever mention Hitler in any statement you ever make about another person that you're describing, particularly if it's an American, and of course, absolutely, if it's a military person. I'm sure you're aware, Damon, Senator Durbin of Illinois used that word about a week ago. He did so by reading verbatim statement by an FBI agent discussing or describing what that agent saw, what he directly observed. And it was terrible, terrible treatment that I won't go into discussing now. And by saying that that was the same kind of treatment that occurred in historical and foreign venues. I'm not going to use the words right now. Senator Durbin brought upon himself tremendous criticism. And for some reason, it was considered that he was criticizing American troops. I'm not even sure that the interrogations that are occurring in Guantanamo Bay, to what extent they're even being done by American troops. CIA people are involved, I believe. Contractors are involved in various places. I don't know to what extent, if any, at Guantanamo. Anyway, I think it's very strange that there is this reflexive reaction whenever anybody compares something in the United States that could be considered an atrocity and say that there are similar characteristics to other historical and international atrocities.
Peter, I wanted to go back to your point on the fact that the United States maintains not only the facility at Guantanamo Bay, which is its own unique creature, but also our prisons and holding facilities worldwide. And I wonder if you could expound on that, because I'm not sure that members of our listening audience are aware, perhaps, of the extent to which we maintain such facilities or sponsor such facilities in any event.
Well, it's officially, I don't think that the United States government is admitting to much as far as where these locations of detention facilities are. We only know for sure of the ones in Afghanistan at Agram Air Force Base, as well as, I think, a second facility, and then the Guantanamo facility. But we also suspect, and there's good reason to believe, that there might be also secret facilities operated by the CIA in Pakistan, for example, and other parts of Iraq that we don't know about. And perhaps even other countries are cooperating with us. We know, for example, that Egypt has been cooperating and interrogating detainees on behalf of the United States government. So it's very hard to know for sure what the truth is, but there are facilities besides Guantanamo, and all these facilities that are under the control of the U.S. government need to be scrutinized as to whether or not they are abiding by the laws that are required. With respect to the criticism Frank referred to, Senator Durbin's apology because he didn't mean to offend the U.S. military personnel, I have a son who is in the military. And I hope that never in his career as a military soldier will any officer ask him to do the kind of things that we have heard American troops have been doing, to interrogate prisoners in the form of abuse and torture. I think that, in fact, is a violation of the military code of ethics, and I think, in fact, I hope that he will resist taking such orders and fulfilling them, because I think the biggest abuse and the biggest apology that is needed from our government currently is to those troops who were told to do these things probably against their better judgment and are now being prosecuted at the lower levels, whereas their superiors and the people giving the orders are not being accused of anything at this time. I think that's pretty outrageous. And the double standard regarding why such an outrage happens when somebody raises criticism about U.S. treatment of prisoners, I think there is a double standard here going on with regard to this very same administration. Dr. Schultz, our executive director, pointed out about the comments that Secretary Rumsfeld made that 20 years ago, 1985, when Amnesty International was criticizing Saddam Hussein's human rights abuses, at the very same time, Donald Rumsfeld was courting Saddam Hussein on behalf of the U.S. government to curry favor with him against in their war against Iran. So apparently back then, Donald Rumsfeld didn't have a problem with dealing with Saddam Hussein. We've been criticizing that human rights record of that government for many years. And now, on many cases that we criticize, such as China and Cuba, the administration agrees with our criticism, but all of a sudden when we criticize their behavior, we're out of line.
Did Amnesty's report, which condoned calling for prosecution of senior officials involved in crimes against humanity, involved in crimes violative of international law, did that raise the particular ire of administration officials? Is that what really was a main criticism of this report that caused such an outrage in the mainstream media of late?
It's very possible that the fact that Amnesty in its statement mentioned people by name and said these are possibly suspicious individuals with regard to prosecution for a conspiracy to allow abuse and torture to happen. And among the list of people that was mentioned, let me just mention them too, William Hayes, Defense Department General Counsel, who wrote the memo, said that it was okay to do certain techniques. Douglas Fate, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who cited the same memo as concurring with his own recommendations. Major General Jeffrey Miller, commander of the Joint Task Force in Guantanamo, whose subordinates used some of the approved torture techniques and then took them to Iraq and recommended their use there. CIA Director George Tenet, whose agency kept so-called ghost detainees off the logs and hid them from the International Red Cross. Also, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who called the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete, when in fact most senior military people will say the Geneva Convention is what protects our own forces from abuse by others. And finally, with regard to the Abu Ghraib atrocities, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, as well as his Deputy Major General Walter Wojtkowski, and Captain Carolyn Woods. All of these are people that we, our organization, considers in need of investigation because they may have been a part of a supporting conspiracy to allow these things to happen.
You're listening to WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio, Making Waves segment here on Saturday afternoon. My guests today are Frank Heffron and Peter Somsich, and we're discussing today the imprisonment of persons detained in the United States' so-called War on Terror. Frank, I'd like to turn specifically to the case that you've been involved in, the case of Murat Kurnaz, currently in prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Could you tell our listening audience, those who may or may not know much about Mr. Kurnaz's case, what you can, if you can share with us about some of the specifics of his case, the facts, how you may have gotten involved in that case, and where the case stands today?
Damon, I certainly am happy to discuss the case of Murat Kurnaz. Back in the fall last year, our local chapter, which was working then on cases in Iran and in another country, I was a new member at the time, we were contacted by Amnesty International USA, and we were asked, would we like to work on a case of a detainee at Guantanamo Bay? And that seems strange because it's been our experience that normally we work on cases of people who are imprisoned in other countries. But it seemed like it would be a very interesting thing and something that I definitely was interested in. And Peter, who's our chairman, called me and said, if we get this case, Frank, would you want to work on it? And I said, I definitely would. So they sent us the case in January, that is to say about a 12-page printed document describing the facts of his case and discussing the kinds of things we could do to be helpful. Murat Kurnaz was born and raised in Germany, but he and his family are Turkish nationals. They were guest workers in Germany. They lived there for many, many years and never became German citizens. They became reasonably prosperous. His father worked in the Daimler plant. Long shifts, they seemed to live in a nice home. Murat grew up as a normal young man in the European community. He played music. He went to the gym a lot. He did all right in school. Around 2000 or 2001, he became more and more interested in his religion, which was Islam. The family had been attending a mosque, but he was inclined to attend a different mosque, which I've heard is referred to as the Moroccan mosque. And he really thought that his people were not being treated well. In the summer of 2001, among other things, and I don't know really the background on this, but he went to Turkey and he married a young woman there in Turkey. But she was unable to travel to Germany immediately. She could not get there until December. So he returned to Germany and decided that he would take a trip with some missionaries, Islam Missionary Society, and tour Pakistan. Now, this happened to be shortly after September 11, 2001. Not the best time to go to Pakistan. And by the time he got there and was traveling around, going from mosque to mosque and school to school, sometimes sleeping in mosques, the war in Afghanistan was well underway, and Pakistan was trying to show that they were supporting the United States, and one way to show that was to turn over people who were suspected of illegal activity, suspected of being terrorists, to the United States. So it turns out that after 2 months approximately in Pakistan, Murat, who had a ticket back to Germany in his pocket and was on a bus to the airport, was pulled off the airport and detained by the Pakistani authorities, who shortly thereafter turned them over to the Americans. The Americans took him. Now he went to Afghanistan while a detainee of the United States. He was at, I believe, Kandahar Air Force Base. He was mistreated there, so he alleges. Early in 2002, he was among the second or third wave of detainees who were sent to Guantanamo Bay, which, of course, was chosen as being in a foreign country in Cuba and was considered to be an ideal location that would be far away from the reach of American law. So he's been detained in Guantanamo Bay since early 2002. He started out age 19. He's now over 22. His family heard from him last in a postcard sent to his mother in May of 2002. His mother retained or engaged a German attorney, Bernhard Tocke is the name. He worked very vigorously trying to obtain legal redress for Murat Kurnaz and also getting a lot of publicity for him in Germany. And he brought Mrs. Kurnaz, the mother, to the United States at the convocation run by the, I believe, the Center for Human Rights and the ACLU. And there was a lot of publicity at the time. But they didn't get to visit their son, and nothing was heard of him. Years went by, and the Red Cross made visits to Guantanamo Bay, but nothing was heard from Murat Kurnaz. As you mentioned earlier, just about a year ago, at the end of June, the U.S. Supreme Court surprisingly rendered a decision that the United States courts do indeed have jurisdiction over the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Kurnaz, who had by then an American lawyer, a professor at Seton Hall University, his name is Bahir Azmi, was permitted last fall to go to Guantanamo Bay and interview Kurnaz for 2 days. He heard more stories of inhuman and degrading treatment. Again, I won't go into the specifics. I believe there was something akin to waterboarding, deprivation of food for long periods of time. And at one point, an officer or an interrogator pointed a pistol at him and said, "Well, I'm going to shoot you." And his response was, "That would be just fine with me." He couldn't see any reason why he would not want to be shot. Well, he was not shot. And his attorney came back to the United States and was among several who filed habeas corpus petitions. That case in the district court for the District of Columbia got to a single judge, District Judge Joyce Hens Green. She had about 20 or 30 cases before her, or she was in charge of deciding specific issues relating to several cases. But she picked out the case of Murat Kurnaz, and she said, "Well, let's look at the facts." She reviewed the unclassified evidence against Murat Kurnaz. He had been given one of these review tribunal hearings before three military officers who put tape over their name tags. You could tell their branch of service and their rank, but not their name. And I guess some press people were authorized to be there. When he was asked, "Apparently you've been associating with someone who was going to be a suicide bomber. Tell us who that was." And he said, "I don't know of anybody who was going to be a suicide bomber."
Did he have the opportunity to have a lawyer present? Did he have an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses or to examine evidence in advance of this hearing? Could you tell us a little about the rules of evidence? Did he have any of the constitutional rights that we've come to know or expect here as citizens of the United States?
No, Damon, he certainly did not. He had none of those rights. He did not have an attorney. He was not allowed to see what the evidence was against him. He didn't see any witnesses testifying. He had no training in the law. And as I was saying, when he asked them to be more specific about what the charges were, they said, "Well, we can't tell you that." It was a real catch-22 situation. As I say, the case did to get to this district court judge in Washington, D.C. She reviewed all the evidence against him and said it was, at most, guilt by association. He might have been associating with people who either were terrorists or wanted to be terrorists, but there was no indication that he had taken any action himself. She did indeed look at the classified information, when you read the decision, you see two pages which are all blacked out because the public was not permitted to see that. But she then did, after she described the classified evidence against him, she summarized it. And she said, this too does not constitute, for him to be detained on the basis of evidence of this nature would be a deprivation of due process of law. Unfortunately, that case is on appeal. Briefs have been submitted, but no oral argument has been had, and there's no court order that allows him to go out. One interesting thing is that requests are made by these organizations. I mentioned before the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights. They're always asking for documents to be produced, and eventually some documents were produced. And lo and behold, the classified evidence against Murat Kurnaz was unclassified briefly. And his attorney very wisely immediately called a press conference, spread all that evidence, so-called evidence, upon the record, and it's now been reclassified, but it's out there in the public domain. Shortly after that happened, the Washington Post, in late March of this year, they wrote an article. The headline was something to the effect, "Panel ignores evidence of detainees' innocence." And they went into the facts of this case at some length. This case has also been discussed by the New York Times just early this month. They did quite a write-up in early June. The reporter went to Bremen, Germany, which is the home of the family and where Murat Kurnaz grew up. He interviewed people. I learned many facts myself after much research that I had not known until I read the article. The point about Murat Kurnaz is I call him the poster boy for those who are swept up, against whom there is nothing approaching adequate evidence, but there they sit in Guantanamo Bay, just exactly the same as the people who were trying to undermine and attack the United States of America. And our government officials come out and say, well, these are not altar boys that we have down there. These are people who are trying to undermine and attack and kill us. Well, that just does not seem to be the case, as far as I know and understand, with Murat Kurnaz. It's probably also true with respect to several others.
Which is a question I have, and maybe, Peter, you might be able to address it. To what extent is Murat's case similar to those, or dissimilar, as the case may be, to those of other matters that Amnesty has taken note of and looked at in recent years?
Not as obviously as this case, although there are similarities in the sense that many governments have detained and imprisoned people without any real evidence and claimed that they were a threat to the country or terrorists. In fact, one of the concerns that Amnesty has had from day one with regard to our procedures in Afghanistan and Iraq as a government is that by setting bad precedents, breaking international norms and agreements, and saying we can do that because this is a war on terrorism, we are now basically saying that allows us to do all kinds of things that would otherwise not be allowed. And there are many governments out there who have prisoners, political prisoners and others, that we work for those prisoners. These governments are taking their cue from our government, saying, oh, well, if the U.S. government can say their opponents are terrorists and do all these things, then certainly we can claim that our prisoners in our jails are all terrorists, and that's why we can do all these things, including abuse and torture. And I think as an American, and especially as a immigrant who came to this country, I'm deeply offended by the idea that our country that used to have a very good human rights record in supporting these efforts worldwide. In fact, I always say that when I first started working for Amnesty International, I heard the phrase mentioned in the organization that a human rights violation in one country is a human rights violation in all the countries, because everyone should be affronted if that happens. And I thought, well, you know, as an American citizen, I say this, but I don't ever expect our country to do those kind of violations and to be called on the carpet for it. But in fact, that's what has happened. And I'm sure that most Americans, and I'm sure that most of our military personnel, are also offended by being asked to abuse or torture people under their custody. I want to also say that Amnesty International does not support and try to get released anyone who has advocated violence or supports violence. That has been our policy since the organization started in 1961, and it's still our policy today. We're not interested in letting anyone go free who is a terrorist in the sense of being a violent criminal. What we're saying is these people have to have fair hearing. They have to have representation by lawyers, like everyone else who's accused of a serious crime. And there are international laws that we have signed on to that make it an obligation for us to do that. And our country has to abide by these things. Actually, recently, both Frank and I have been encouraged by some letters that we have received from Congressman Bradley, who's taken up this case for us a little bit, as well as by Senator Judd Gregg. And before I give this over to Frank, he can say something about Congressman Bradley's efforts. I just want to say that I have this letter in front of me dated June 3rd from Senator Gregg, in which he thanks me for contacting regarding the treatment of detainees on the global war on terror. And he's mentioned specifically that in October 2004, the president and Judd Gregg himself supported and signed into law the Fiscal Year 2005 National Defense Authorization Act, which addresses the issue of detainees. And he goes on to point out that there are 5 points that he mentions. The U.S. is obligated to ensure that no detainee shall be subject to torture or cruel or inhumane treatment that is prohibited by the Constitution, our own laws, or treaties that the United States has signed, that we are obligated to investigate and prosecute any such allegations, that we are ensuring that all personnel working for the United States government understand their obligations in wartime and peacetime to comply with these legal prohibitions, that we ensure that there is no doubt that when a detainee is first imprisoned, he has to have Geneva Convention protections until a proper panel has determined that he is not a prisoner of war, and until then he has that protection. And finally, that the United States expeditiously should process and, if appropriate, prosecute any detainees in their custody, including those in Guantanamo. And I think that's very laudatory that he says this. Unfortunately, why is this law not being enforced?
Frank, what's next for Murat Kurnaz?
It's very difficult to say what's next for Murat Kurnaz. I don't know whether he's going to be in Guantanamo Bay for another 3 to 6 or 12 months, or whether he's going to be there for the rest of his life. This war on terror is something that seems to be a permanent situation. I cannot conceivably see any point in time when the current president of the United States would come before the American people and say, we have banished terrorism. It's like saying we've banished hunger, we've banished murder. I can't see how it's ever going to be possible that the war on terror as currently defined will ever be over. So I hope for the best. As Peter says, we've obtained some cooperation from Congressman Bradley. There are calls around the country among Republicans and Democrats to even close down Guantanamo. Our goal is much more modest. It's really what Peter was reading from the letter from Senator Gregg, which states the current state of the law. These people are entitled to a proceeding before a competent tribunal to see whether or not they are entitled to prisoner of war status or whether they ought to be released. And that's what I think particularly Murat Kurnaz is entitled to.
I'd like to ask each of you for any concluding thoughts or remarks. If there's something of particular note that each of you would like to mention to our listening audience, and I'm thinking that perhaps our listening audience might feel that there might be something they might be able to do in support of Mr. Kurnaz, and maybe if you could incorporate that into some of your remarks.
Well, I think it's important to not get caught up too much in the fear aspect of everything. This war on terrorism is a war that, as Frank mentioned, is a never-ending war. Terrorism has been around for a long time, certainly longer than our organization has been around. And most countries of the world have dealt with their own form of terrorism, whether it's in Ireland or in Spain or in Greece and Germany or in Asia, by doing better police work, by prosecuting people who are accused of terrorism and violence, and by abiding by the laws on the books to do that. We too can do this. We can use the laws in place and the cooperation by other governments to bring to courts and to justice those people who actually have perpetrated a crime. But we have to be able to prove that case, and that person has some rights. And I think we should insist on that. I think we as Americans, with our tradition of support of human rights, I think back of Jimmy Carter's presidential period where he emphasized particularly how human rights has to be an integral part of our foreign policy. And I think most Americans applauded that, and we applaud that today. And we have to bring up to our politicians' attention every time we have an opportunity that this country stands for human rights and is against abuse and torture, no matter where it occurs. And we should not let go of that idea.
Well, I certainly agree with Peter. I would just urge people to write letters to the editor, write letters to your congressman, and ask for a real thorough investigation of what is going on with our detainees at Guantanamo Bay and other locations, and not just pin it on low-level military personnel. We need a 9/11-type commission consisting of former governors, former senators, people who are willing to call it as it is. And my final word is, many people will say that responsibility for this clearly appears to go up to Secretary Rumsfeld. Many feel it definitely goes up to President Bush. And I feel that President Bush has a boss, too. We are his boss. And I'm afraid we are, in a sense, all responsible for what's going on.
There's a very famous quote out there saying that silence is the voice of complicity. And to the extent that we are charged with the knowledge of abuses and we fail to take action, whether we're ordinary citizens or congresspeople, I think that could reflect very strongly in our standing in the world and reflects on to what extent we may have lost some of our humanity. So I think it's a point well taken. Gentlemen, I want to thank you each very much for being here today. I think you inspired our listening audience and informed them to a degree that they may not otherwise have been informed. So on behalf of Making Waves, I'm Damon Thomas. I thank my guests and my listeners for listening to this today, and we now continue with the rest of the show. See you next time.